first oral argument case on the Southern Panel's calendar is Simon Self Storage Partners et al. Versus Rib Roof. We're fortunate to have some talented lawyers this morning to argue this case, and we look forward to your arguments. Are you ready to proceed? Okay, Mr. Knight.
No, Your Honor, it's a pleasure to be here. First, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal argument, if I may.
Yes, sir.
All issues raised during the appeal have their genesis in one of three distinct areas of error made by the district court when it issued its third amended findings of fact, conclusions of law, order, and judgment. First, Rib Roof failed to meet its burden of proof in demonstrating that the materials disputed were ever furnished to any of the six job sites. Second error was that the liens against the Lakemead, Silver Creek, Anthem, and Horizon properties should have been released pursuant to the posting of lien release bonds. Lastly, the third area of error is that the unconditional releases and waivers were valid and signed by Rib Roof's authorized agent in releasing approximately $543,854.88 in claimed materials against the Lakemead and Silver Creek projects. Speaking of the first issue, Your Honor, with respect to the failure to demonstrate furnishing of goods to the job sites, NRS 108.222 is clear. It requires that a lien claimant has a lien upon property and any improvements for which the work, materials, and equipment are furnished.
Let's deal with, I guess, since you quoted that, there's an issue as to definitions of material, and there's also an issue as to definition of furnish. How do you deal with those two things right off the bat so that we can navigate through the statute itself?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Furnished is what I will submit is that the version of furnished that has been submitted by the respondents is an incorrect application of the law. Based
do we have a definition in the NRS of either one of those terms?
Under the NRS, we do not, but I believe that Opaka Lumber is instructive. Opaka Lumber defines that furnished means delivered to the job site, or that it relates to materials that are actually incorporated into the structure.
Now, because of this issue as to the definitions, do we have an informal ambiguity that we need to look at statutory, legislative history?
I don't believe that there's any need, that there's no ambiguity. Furnished means what it means. It means delivered to the site pursuant to this court's ruling in Opaka Lumber, furnished to a delivery site so that the major evidence that, let me back up.
So we would bootstrap the previous case that was in existence prior to this new amendment.
That's what I think we would do, because the 2003 version of the statute specifically contemplates those two options, either incorporation into the structure or delivery to the site. What we're dealing with here is specifically allowing a third party that is not contracting with the owner to encumber another's property without constituting the surrender. And in order to be able to do that, there has to be a heightened standard. The standard that the respondents would have this court follow is that if it was intended to be furnished, or if it was put on a truck and sent to its destination, that qualifies furnishing, but that's more akin of enforcing a contract right, not an elevated lien right.
Well, I asked the question about furnishing because in today's construction world, a lot of material is offloaded, so to speak, to off-site locations because the job site is just so crammed up with machinery and other things that the backlog of what's brought in is placed someplace else initially and then brought to the site at a later date. How are we to deal with that in terms of this issue of mechanic service?
I would say that absent an agreement and acknowledgement by the general contractor or the owner of the property that a staging area is sufficient to constitute delivery to a site, that it hasn't been properly furnished to a property.
So in this particular case, we have it delivered to a location that is not the job site.
That's correct. Well, it actually, what we have is that some instances it was delivered to a location, not the job site. Other instances it was delivered directly to the subcontractor. The overwhelming testimony during the trial was that it was only proven to be sent on a truck and sent away, and then the court made the leap that it was received by the contracting party, Southwest Steel. In fact, Judge Johnson stated, Mr. Moser, who was the CEO, all you can tell me is that it was put on a truck in Texas or California, and it was sent on its intended destination. And when you read the briefs of the opposing party, they state that the mere intent to furnish, regardless of where it actually ends up, constitutes furnishing. But what if things are lost in transit? What if they are, like what was the case here, Tom Carroll testified that he used this steel all over the place on multiple different jobs that he was contracting with Red Roof, and other jobs when it wasn't contracting with Red Roof, which don't even relate to the six here. And so if we think of the unique nature of the lien statute, vesting a property right when you don't even have a contract with the owner, it's this quasi-right, you have to follow a heightened standard. Otherwise, when we're balancing the equities to the parties, we have to consider the rights and equities of the owners as well, that they have a right to have the title to property free from any slander for materials that never went into the building that are somewhere down the street in somebody else's project.
Well, Nevada, in looking at Fountain Blue, is very protective of people who supply materials. So the question is, how does it all fit in?
Fountain Blue is relating to a standard of the statute that exists now, so we're talking two different things. The statute as it applied in 2003 requires that the goods be furnished, and OPACA is instructive in that regard. If we're talking about the statutory construction right now, which is, I would submit, is not necessarily before this court, Fountain Blue does protect the equities and interests of the lien claimant, but it can't be at the expense of an owner, okay? And so now the statute is that that it's sufficient to have a lien if goods are actually furnished or to be furnished. So what I would submit the standard should be is that when there is a valid contract for goods intended to be furnished or to be incorporated into a structure, it creates a rebuttable presumption that they, in fact, were delivered and incorporated. And what that does is that rebuttable presumption allows the owner to come back and say, no, you were a breaching supplier. You were constantly late in delivering materials, or it went down the street. And it also maintains the duty of that supplier to mitigate its damages in case it has a contract for $1 million worth of steel, delivers $50,000 worth, and has a yard now full of $950,000 worth of steel.
So, Mr. Knight, if the court were to adopt that approach here, I guess I'm struggling factually with why there's much of a difference. The way I understood the record, there were 80 bills of lading, 19 of which were missing the consignee's signature. But even with respect to the 19, your client did not refute at trial the deliveries associated with those 19 deliveries. So factually, why wouldn't, under the analysis you just offered, wouldn't the presumption prevail? I don't see anything in the evidence where you responded to that presumption. Can you clarify this for me? I'm struggling to understand how the facts in this case help support your position on your analysis, even if the court were inclined to adopt it.
So what you mentioned of all of those 80 delivery tickets and the 19 that were unsigned, and the remainders, the CEO of Ribbrook, Vern Moser, was unable to confirm actual delivery to the site or acknowledge or authenticate any of the signatures purportedly from Southwest Steel. Tom Carroll, the principal of Southwest Steel, was never presented as well. So there's a complete disconnect as to proof that these goods actually hit a job site to even have an opportunity to go into the structure. Jim Hammer also testified that he was not there on a day-to-day basis watching, inventorying these goods come into the project, and Captain McGlory, who was the controller for Rib Roof, also acknowledged and testified that there was approximately $389,109.99 worth of additional materials for steel that had to be purchased to complete the projects when Southwest was removed from the project. When we take those facts, coupled with the fact that they never authenticate any of these documents to prove delivery, and then Tom Carroll saying that this steel can be used interchangeably, and he could easily cut it down and use it on another project, and that he often directed Rib Roof or the driver, the carrier, dropping the steel off to take it to a totally different project other than the six here, allows us to prevent a situation where someone is merely claiming by simple presentation of an unauthenticated delivery ticket or bill of lading, and and say, yes, I have property rights and a legal interest in the structure of that building because my steel went there. Okay?
All I'm saying, 59 of these signed by an employee of your client?
No, the testimony was that they were signed by Southwest Steel. Okay? And no one authenticated the signatures. All it says is Southwest Steel with a signature, but no one authenticated who it was. The only person testifying to those...
Did you refute those signatures or the authentication that... did you challenge the authentication of the document? I thought these were all admitted.
They were all admitted, but they weren't authenticated. They were admitted with respect to a business record, not as to the fact that it was confirmed, proof of confirmed delivery and receipt by Southwest. Tom Carroll was never called.
Once admitted, can't the court rely on the document as evidence, circumstantial evidence of the delivery?
Except for the fact that Judge Johnson expressly stated, okay, Mr. Moser, I'm giving you some leeway here in talking about these documents that you say, here, there's a signature, but you don't know who that is. You don't know who that person is. You don't know if that's a valid signature. And then Judge Johnson said, so Mr. Moser, you're saying all you know is that there's a bill of lading, an acknowledgement, a receipt, you put it on a truck, and you sent it to a destination. But that's all you can say.
But at the end of the day, the way I read the judge's findings, she concluded that this was delivered, and aren't we required as an appellate court to provide deference to the findings of fact by the trial judge?
Your Honor, the findings of fact are reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and there was specifically the judge...
No, they're reviewed for substantial evidence, right?
Okay, I apologize. Yeah. But, and the court does give substantial evidence.
Am I right about that, or... We should review that for substantial evidence?
That, yes, Your Honor, but they're inseparably linked to the requirements of the lien statutes to demonstrate under 108.222 that the goods were in fact furnished. Couple that with a PACO to the deliveries to the job site or incorporated into the structure. And so it is our position, unequivocally, that Judge Johnson completely ignored 2.5 days worth of trial of Ron Moser, that he never once could authenticate a single signature demonstrating receipt by any party. So we're stating that Judge Johnson completely ruled contrary in her findings of fact, contrary to the actual evidence presented, and because that is part of the duty under 108.222 to demonstrate furnishing, now we're dealing with an issue of law as to what constitutes furnishing, which I think this court can look at and reconsider de novo.
I know we've asked you a number of questions and you wanted to reserve 4 minutes, but before we sit down, I'd like you to address one other area. I don't think you mentioned at your opening, and that's the posting of the bonds. Could you clarify for me that there were bonds posted, as I understand it? Is that correct? And that those bonds covered... four of the projects?
That's correct, Your Honor. The bonds covered four of the projects, the Lake Mead Project, Silver Creek Project, Anthem Project, and Horizon Project.
And the judge recites the correct statutes in her order about these bonds, but then seems to still compel sales of the properties to satisfy the mechanics liens. I think you assigned this as error in your briefs, but wondered what you had to say about that issue.
What I had to say is that the judge specifically ignored NRS 108.2415, which states that when a release bond is posted, it replaces the actual lien for security. Okay, it removes that slander against title, so to speak. Here's what's interesting is that Woodruff even states in its answering brief that the bonds were properly posted in place and for the proper amounts. Okay? And Woodruff even stipulated for the removal of those liens and amended its complaint to remove those foreclosure of lien claims and rather reinstated the claim so that it was against the bonds only. So we think that the court completely turned its back on the whole entire purpose of 108.2413 and 2415 when it said, as added security in case these amounts are insufficient to satisfy a judgment, it should remain. At the time, there was no judgment, okay, and this was presented even in a summary judgment fashion that it should be removed. And the point that I want to make is the judge had the opportunity to request an increase of the penal sum of the bond. That was never requested by Woodruff, and that was never ordered by the judge. The statute already contemplates the proper remedy not to have double encumbrance with a bond and a lien on the property.
Thank you, Mr. Knight. Ms. Clerk, add 3 minutes to his time, and you'll have 18 minutes. Mr. Mead, you ready to go?
I am indeed, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm on the electronic gizmos that I started to use.
You've got quite a few pads there.
I do. I'm trying to keep it all straight. It's a pleasure to appear before you again. Haven't had the opportunity to appear before you, Justice Horace Segal. I appreciate it. I'll just begin by addressing the issues that were raised on questions. First of all, I don't understand this argument that the materials were never delivered to the job site. I think that the testimony was very clear that it was. Tom Carroll, who did in fact testify at the trial, testified to the question, would we ship the materials to Southwest Steel, which were used in those West Star Las Vegas projects, right? And, isn't that correct? And the answer was they were shipped to the job sites. They weren't shipped to Southwest Steel or somewhere nearby. And he goes on to testify that what he did was, on occasion, because it was a very wet year, the job sites themselves couldn't be accessed to drop off the material, so he would send it to a staging area very close nearby, and that's where it would be dropped off. So there is no dispute. And I might add, that's the record fact.
Is that record site to 27 AA5457?
I'm sorry, 27
Appendix 5457?
It is actually, 27, I think it's 27, 5454 through 5456 is what I was quoting from.
Okay.
Thank you. So the testimony was there that the judge could rely on that the material was delivered to the job site by Mr. Carroll. Now, obviously, he's with Southwest, and he's the one in charge of that company to receive it. Beyond that, though, if you look at all the invoices, all the bills of lading, everything else that was put through by Woodruff in terms of supporting their materials, it all indicates that it's shipped to the job site. So there is delivery to the job site. Now, whether or not it gets there is a difficult situation. There seems to be an indication that it was. Material certainly was used in these projects. Steel was, in any event. And there's no testimony at all that this material was not used in these jobs, just that they didn't know. Typical for material suppliers, very difficult for material suppliers to know when the job site, the material actually hits the job, so they do the installation.
What do you do, Mr. Mead, with the 19 bills of lading, though, that don't contain a consignee's signature?
I don't think you need to worry about that, because I think that the mere fact that the material was intended, manufactured specifically for those buildings, and was shipped by the Woodruff to those buildings, it got there. There was no testimony that it didn't get there. There was nothing offered in response or in rebuttal that would indicate someone else supplied these materials. And the clear evidence was that they were needed for these projects. We wouldn't be standing here if Woodruff hadn't provided the material. It's very difficult for material to supplier to be able to prove definitively that their material is always in the job site.
Counsel, I asked the question that the subordinate spoke originally. As the terms of art furnishing material, how do you deal with those terms of art?
Well, actually, there's a definition of material that was in 2003 amendments. And there isn't a definition of the word furnished. However, I can tell you from experience that back to the Halbert Lumber case, there's a very clear determination of what furnished means in that case. And basically, it's delivered. When you delivered it to the job site. Plus the fact that these materials were actually delivered to the job site or designated areas for the job site.
Are we to consider that designated area part of the job site? And we're back to definitions again.
I think you have to. Because as you mentioned when you asked the question, projects don't always have a place for you to lay things down or even accurate locations to lay things out. Many times materials are long lead items that have to be stored somewhere. and can't be safely stored on a job site, and so they'll store them off-site in a secure location. It's not any less delivered. It's available. It's made available under the definition of furnished would really be to make it available to the other side.
But the quandary then is it used on a specific job or can it be used at multiple locations? That's kind of the problem we're grappling with the way the statute is set up.
I understand. And here's where we really have a distinction. The court and I have had disagreements on whether or not California law should be used to interpret our statutes. I think that it shouldn't be. One of the reasons is California requires use and consumption. We merely require furnishing. Okay, so there's an intention of quality. It's an intention by the person who provides the material or provides labor to furnish a specific project. There's not a mandate that that be used in the project, or it is in California. Statutes are specifically clear on that point. And I will tell you that when the changes were made in 2003 to the statutes here in Nevada, we specifically wanted to avoid making a relationship directly to California, because California did come out with the Halberts Lumber case, which was extremely unfair to material suppliers. California relates its releases to time. The date that it arrives through the date I say it's released, if anything is there, even though it's not paid for, it's made. That's what Halberts was. Here we don't have that. We relate it back to payment. And even down to the releases themselves, which I've gotten into, and you didn't ask about those, the releases are very clear about payment. And even when an unconditional release is given in exchange for a check, that bounces so that no payment is made, that release is of no value whatsoever. And there's no waiver at all. That was in subsection 4E of 2457 in the 2003 version, subsection 5E now. Getting back beyond that, on the sale of the property, I think there's a situation we have here is not so much that the judge didn't release the mechanics lien off the property. And it's a fairly inarticulate argument, I will admit, judgment, I should say, on that regard. But I think she came to the right result. This court has allowed many times the judgment to stand when the court hasn't done it the right way, but nevertheless gets to the right result. And what's going on in this case is that even in light of the surety bond, the statute in 2003 says that the mechanics lien claimant is entitled to a judgment for the full lien amount in accordance with 108.237. 108.237 goes through and lays down the amounts, the attorney's fees and costs, and then says and any other amount that the court feels is appropriate. It specifically addresses both the mechanics lien claim and surety bond claim. It then goes on to order sale. The process of sale. 108.238 says that nothing in the mechanics lien statutes limits the right of a lien claimant to obtain a judgment against somebody who owes them money for it. And then after that, in 2 through 9, you have a number of statutes, subsections 10, 11, and 12, that say not only are you entitled, if the property is sold and it's insufficient to cover the claims, that the lien claimant is entitled to a deficiency judgment on that. And it can be prosecuted against the person who may exercise a personal judgment.
Counsel, that's all very well, and I appreciate that, but we have four bonds that were posted for an adequate sum, not contested, as the validity, and the judge as to 4 of the 6, judge just blows right through it. Comes out there.
Not quite. She goes through a painstaking process to lay out each property, how much exactly is laid out from there. And then what she says with regard to owning the property sold is only after the bonds have been exhausted if there's not enough. So clearly under the statute in 239, there's an allowance for a deficiency against the party who owes it and against who the judgment's for. And in this case, they have a judgment is entered against the property owners for unjust enrichment. Now, if there's a deficiency there, it's very clear that if it's covered, what's owed by those parties is covered by the bond claim, you can't sell the property.
But only after, Your Honor, if I might, in light of the statute, wouldn't it have been more appropriate for the court to ask for the bonds to be increased?
Well, it's not the court that orders the bonds increased. Rickles would have done that.
We have a situation, Counsel. We have an amount posted as required.
And we're
walking through this, and you're saying the court did this, and this, and then I say, well, shouldn't the court have done this? And so, well, it's not the court's duty. Well, that is the question. What is the court's duty in light of the statute?
I think in light of the statute, the court did what its duty was. Because I don't think that what the order of sale of those properties after the bonds were covered is not in the mechanism statute. She mentioned it's Chapter 21, which is the statute in 21080 that specifically allows for a judgment debtor's property, real property, be sold in satisfaction of the judgment.
So, Mr. Mina, in referring to page 24 and 25 of the judgment, where the judge specifies amounts, let's take as an example item 2, $106,098.46 as against defendants, and then it lists Anthem and Southwest, and then finally this Western Surety Company, parentheses, the surety for the project.
Mm-hmm.
Is your argument that the form of that judgment is sort of a joint and several liability, that you look to the surety first, and then to the extent that the bond has failed to cover the amount, then the balance would be recovered against the other defendants?
Yes. Well, technically, you could, I guess, chase against all the other defendants, but as she's written it out there, that's how she's playing it out. She says, listen, if you go after the property, you got to get the bond.
Uh-huh.
Once the bond's exhausted, then it's a personal judgment, and you can sell the property after under Chapter 21.
But is that consistent with the judge's discussion of the bond process in finding 20 on pages 17 and 18, which under 108.242.1.2A1 and 2415, once the complaint has been amended and the surety is substituted, only the judgment can be entered against the surety?
That's on the bond. Yeah, no, it can be on the principal and the surety and against the lien claimant's debtor, is what the statute actually says. But that's just on the bond claim. That's not on the unjust enrichment claim.
Yeah.
The unjust enrichment claim, the property may be released. You have to realize that a mechanic's lien doesn't reach itself, doesn't reach into the pocket of the homeowner or the property owner.
Mm-hmm.
It merely allows for sale of the property. After that, if you've got a personal judgment, that's what the statute goes through and says that if you don't get enough money, you can get a personal judgment now. So there's an obligation to exhaust that remedy under the mechanics in the statute, and only after that can you go after the personal judgment. And that's what she's doing. I will admit that the judgment was not clear. We took three shots at it. In fact, one of them came before this court, you know, came back and said, no, you have to sell it first, which that's fine. So we're doing the best we can on that, but that's the intent. I can tell you that was the, you know, argument and discussion that occurred when we went back to the judge and asked her to do the argument again, or the judgment a third time after the previous written ruling. That was the discussion.
Should this court, part of the reason this is on for oral argument, is should this court resolve this case by opinion and clarify the circumstances under which judgments are entered when adequate bonds are posted?
Well, I certainly think that perhaps it might not be a bad idea. I think the statute is not clear as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the intent is the statute as you walk through it. It got a little bit clearer in 2005. We were able to clean up a few things.
So if such an opinion were prepared, how would you suggest it be framed?
Well, I would suggest that it be framed to say that when you have a mechanics lien judgment, that to the extent the lien judgment is there, the property is sold for that. And if you have a personal judgment against the individuals who are otherwise liable for it under other theories. I mean, I think you have to say that because the statute clearly says it doesn't impact other claims of theory. But as to the property, it should be sold. And if there is a deficiency, then under the statute, the balance can be obtained through a personal judgment claim. When the bond is released, I think the statute should really say that to the extent of the bond, that's the liability of the surety. And that if there is a deficiency beyond that for the attorney's fees and anything else that may be there, it's probably going to be there and might be unique, that again, it should be a personal judgment that rolls back to the persons who are liable for it under the judge's findings. But again, it's a little bit difficult. This case has been 10 years since my client supplied the materials. Hardly getting to a prompt and quick resolution. So it's undoubted, in my view, that once the final judgment comes through, and assuming your honors uphold the judgment, that when we get to the final number, it's going to be beyond 1.5 times the amount of the lien claims on those properties that were bonded around. There's going to be additional money that has to come through. And that's when they're going to have to go through the process of settlement under a judgment through Chapter 21 as a regular personal judgment.
Any other questions from Mr. Mead? Thank you, Mr. Mead. Appreciate your argument this
morning. Thank you, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. Mr. Knight, you may proceed. We haven't talked about Trish Cartwright, but frankly, these other issues are more important for purposes of argument. We don't want to deprive you of that opportunity, but we understand those arguments, I think, don't we? So you might want to focus on the other areas we've been looking at.
Understood. The first comment I'd like to make is to follow up on the coattails of what Mr. Mead just said. My client has suffered with a slander against its title for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And it has had to miss the opportunity of refinancing or reconveying that property, which is specifically why the bonds that get posted are in place, to allow and promote the free flow of commerce. The judge made an error by trying to bootstrap the ability to encumber property with a potential claim pursuant to a lien under 108 and tying it into to NRS 21. If they would have gotten a judgment and there was insufficient amounts there with the bonds, then they can certainly record a judgment against any asset held by the debtor at that time. But when the lien release bonds were posted, there was no debtor who had been determined to be found. So it was improper for Judge Johnson to keep those in place.
So your argument is that under 108-24156A, which the judge recites in her order, the property should have been released at that point, as soon as those bonds were posted.
Unequivocally.
Yeah. What if there is a deficiency? Are your clients liable for the deficiency? The statute doesn't seem to relieve them of liability.
I would agree
the property.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you that it releases specifically the property, and that's the error that the judge made.
Mr. Knight, you do a lot of work in this area. Your firm does. What is your view about the resolution of this case by order or opinion? And if we address by opinion, I know you had a long discussion with Justice Douglas about the issues concerning furnish and delivery, but on the subject we were talking to Mr. Mead about, how would you suggest an opinion in that area to clarify this issue, and how would you frame it?
Your Honor, we're dealing with the 2003 version of the statute, and OPACO is instructive. I keep coming back to that, and the standard hasn't been met. I think this court can resolve those issues as it applies to the 2003 version of the statute by way of a written opinion. There's no evidence that those items were furnished to the job. Judge Johnson specifically stated, Volume 27 of Appellate's Appendix, 5561 to 5562, quote, I'm taking it all in as somebody signed this document that they received it, okay? That's what I'm taking. I don't know that I can take the wild leap right now that someone from Southwest Steel received the goods. Close quote. I want to correct something Mr. Mead stated as well. He's cherry-picking when he states that Tom Carroll said that the property was delivered to the job site. Prior to that, he stated at Appendix 27, page 5451, that it was delivered directly to Southwest Steel. And then, as Your Honor noted, on 5457, he later, after the testimony Mr. Mead cited, corrected himself and said again that he admits that he would tell the group where to send this deal regardless of the job.
But it seems, Mr. Knight, like the trier of fact resolved those inconsistencies in favor of Rib Roof.
It absolutely did, and therein lies the greatest mistake caused by the judge, because her ruling flew directly in the face of 2.5 days worth of testimony that not a single person could connect the dots that this deal was ever reached any of the six job sites or which of the steel was placed, sent to the staging area. The testimony was actually contrary to that. Tom Carroll said he would tell him to send it to another job, another location, down the street. He'd use them interchangeably, send it to Southwest Yard. So what we have are six unique projects with six distinct owners who now are being encumbered with liens for items that never touched their project. Never touched their project. And the statute is clear, 108.222, it has to be furnished to the project. And Opaco says delivery to the site or incorporation of the structure. So we believe the court should reverse entirely Judge Johnson's ruling.
Okay, Mr. Knight, thank you very much for your arguments today. And Mr. Mead, we appreciate your very competent presentations and your briefs and your arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The matter will stand submitted.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor.